I learned its habits and I could almost intuit its route of flight. Yet its speed and the suddenness of its appearance would always baffle me. I could boast that I had prevented it from taking its prey, perhaps every time we had met, but I could never bag it. In the 2 months that I carried on the strange war against the albino falcon, I came close to it only once. I had been chasing it all day and I was tired. I'd sat down to rest and fell asleep under a tall eucalyptus tree. The sudden cry of a falcon woke me up. I opened my eyes without making any other movement and I saw a whitish bird perched in the highest branches of the eucalyptus tree. It was the albino falcon. The chase was over. It was going to be a difficult shot. I was lying on my back and the bird had its back turned to me. There was a sudden gust of wind, and I used it to muffle the noise of lifting my 22 long rifle to take aim. I wanted to wait until the bird had turned or until it had begun to fly, so I wouldn't miss it. But the albino bird remained motionless. In order to take a better shot, I would have needed to move, and the falcon was too fast for that. I thought that my best alternative was to wait, and I did, a long, interminable time. Perhaps what affected me was the long wait, or perhaps it was the loneliness of the spot where the bird and I were. I suddenly felt a chill up my spine, and in an unprecedented action I stood up and left. I didn't even look to see if the bird had flown away. I never attached any significance to my final act with the albino falcon. However, it was terribly strange that I didn't shoot it. I had shot dozens of falcons before. On the farm where I grew up, shooting birds or hunting any kind of animal was a matter of course. Don Juan listened attentively as I told him the story of the albino falcon. "How did you know about the white falcon?" I asked when I had finished.
"I saw it," he replied.
"Where?"
"Right here, in front of you."
I wasn't in an argumentative mood anymore.
"What does all this mean?" I asked.
He said that a white bird like that was an omen, and that not shooting it down was the only right thing to do.
"Your death gave you a little warning," he said with a mysterious tone. "It always comes as a chill."
"What are you talking about?" I said nervously. He really made me nervous with his spooky talk.
"You know a lot about birds," he said. "You've killed too many of them. You know how to wait. You've waited patiently for hours."
"I know that. I am seeing it." His words caused a great turmoil in me. I thought that what annoyed me the most about him was his certainty. I couldn't stand his dogmatic assuredness about the issues in my own life that I wasn't sure of myself. I became engulfed in my feelings of dejection, and I didn't see him leaning over me until he actually had whispered something in my ear. I didn't understand at first, and he repeated it. He told me to turn around casually and look at a boulder to my left. He said that my death was there, staring at me, and if I turned when he signaled me, I might be capable of seeing it. He signaled me with his eyes. I turned, and I thought I saw a flickering movement over the boulder. A chill ran through my body. The muscles of my abdomen contracted involuntarily, and I experienced a jolt, a spasm. After a moment, I regained my composure, and I explained away the sensation of seeing the flickering shadow as an optical illusion caused by turning my head so abruptly. "Death is our eternal companion," Don Juan said with the most serious air. "It is always to our left, at an arm's length. It was watching you when you were watching the white falcon. It whispered in your ear, and you felt its chill
as you felt it today. It's always been watching you. It always will, until the day it taps you.
He extended his arm and touched me lightly on the shoulder, and at the same time he made a deep clicking sound with his tongue. The effect was devastating. I almost got sick to my stomach.
"You're the boy who stalked a game and waited patiently as death waits. You know very well that death is to our left, the same way you were to the left of the White Falcon."
His words had the strange power to plunge me into an unwarranted terror. My only defense was my compulsion to commit to writing everything he said.
"How can anyone feel so important when we know that death is stalking us?" he asked.
I had the feeling my answer was not really needed. I couldn't have said anything anyway. A new mood had possessed me.
"The thing to do when you're impatient," he proceeded, "is to turn to your left and ask advice from your death. An immense amount of pettiness is dropped if your death makes a gesture to you, or if you catch a glimpse of it, or if you just have the feeling that your companion is there, watching you."
He leaned over again and whispered in my ear that if I turned to my left suddenly, upon seeing his signal, I could again see my death on the boulder. His eyes gave me an almost imperceptible signal, but I didn't dare to look. I told him that I believed him, and that he didn't have to press the issue any further, because I was terrified. He had one of his roaring belly laughs. He replied that the issue of our death was never pressed far enough. And I argued that it would be meaningless for me to dwell upon my death, since such a thought would only bring discomfort and fear.
"You're full of crap," he exclaimed. "Death is the only wise advisor that we have. Whenever you feel, as you always do, that everything is going wrong and you're about to be annihilated, turn to your death and ask if that is so. Your death will tell you that you're wrong, that nothing really matters outside its touch. Your death will tell you, 'I haven't touched you yet.'"
He shook his head and seemed to be waiting for my reply. I had none. My thoughts were running rampant. He delivered a staggering blow to my egotism. The pettiness of being annoyed with him was monstrous in the light of my death. I had the feeling he was fully aware of my change of mood. He'd turned the tide in his favor. He smiled and began to hum a Mexican tune.
"Yes," he said softly after a long pause. "One of us here has to change, and fast. One of us here has to learn again that death is the hunter, and that it is always to one's left. One of us here has to ask death's advice and drop the cursed pettiness that belongs to men that live their lives as if death will never tap them."
We remained quiet for more than an hour. Then we started walking again. We meandered in the desert chaparral for hours. I didn't ask him if there was any purpose to it. It didn't matter. Somehow he'd made me recapture an old feeling, something I'd quite forgotten. The sheer joy of just moving around without attaching any intellectual purpose to it. I wanted him to let me catch a glimpse of whatever I'd seen on the boulder.
"Let me see that shadow again," I said.
"You mean your death, don't you?"
he replied with a touch of irony in his voice. For a moment, I felt reluctant to voice it.
"Yes," I finally said, "let me see my death once again."
"Not now,"
he said.
"You're too solid."
"I beg your pardon?" He began to laugh
and for some unknown reason his laughter was no longer offensive and insidious as it had been in the past. I didn't think that it was different from the point of view of its pitch or its loudness or the spirit of it. The new element was my mood. In view of my impending death, my fears and annoyance were nonsense. "Let me talk to plants, then," I said. He roared with laughter. "You're too good now," he said, still laughing. "You go from one extreme to the other. Be still. There's no need to talk to plants unless you want to know their secrets. And for that, you need the most unbending intent. So save your good wishes. There's no need to see your death either. It's sufficient that you feel its presence around you." Five, assuming responsibility. Tuesday, April 11th, 1961. I arrived at Don Juan's house in the early morning on Sunday, April 9th. "Good morning, Don Juan," I said. "Am I glad to see you?" He looked at me and broke into a soft laughter. He had walked to my car as I was parking it and held the door open while I gathered some packages of food that I'd brought for him. We walked to the house and sat down by the door. This was the first time I had been really aware of what I was doing there. For 3 months, I had actually looked forward to going back to the field. It was as if a time bomb set within myself had exploded, and suddenly I had remembered something transcendental to me. I had remembered that once in my life, I had been very patient and very efficient. Before Don Juan could say anything, I asked him the question that had been pressing hard in my mind. For 3 months, I had been obsessed with the memory of the albino falcon. How did he know about it when I myself had forgotten? He laughed, but didn't answer. I pleaded with him to tell me. "It was nothing," he said with his usual conviction. "Anyone could tell that you're strange. You're just numb, that's all." I felt that he was again getting me off guard and pushing me into a corner in which I didn't care to be. "Is it possible to see our death?" I asked, trying to remain within the topic. "Sure," he said, laughing. "It's here, with us." "How do you know that?" "I'm an old man. With age, one learns all kinds of things." "I know lots of old people, but they've never learned this. How come you did?" "Well, let's say that I know all kinds of things, because I don't have a personal history, and because I don't feel more important than anything else, and because my death is sitting with me, right here." He extended his left arm and moved his fingers as if he were actually petting something. I laughed. I knew where he was leading me. The old devil was going to clobber me again, probably with my self-importance, but I didn't mind this time. The memory that once I'd had a superb patience had filled me with a strange, quiet euphoria that had dispelled most of my feelings of nervousness and intolerance towards Don Juan. What I felt instead was a sensation of wonder about his acts. "Who are you, really?" I asked. He seemed surprised. He opened his eyes to an enormous size and blinked like a bird, closing his eyelids as if they were a shutter. They came down and went up again, and his eyes remained in focus. His maneuvers startled me, and I recoiled, and he laughed with childlike abandon. "For you, I am Juan Matus, and I am at your service," he said with exaggerated politeness. I then asked my other burning question. "What did you do to me the first day we met?" I was referring to the look he had given me. "Me?
Nothing, he replied, with a tone of innocence. I described to him the way I'd felt when he had looked at me, and how incongruous it had been for me to be tongue-tied.